I'm Dr. Omar Khan.
I'm Dr. Shannon Gowland.
I'm Dr. Tiffany Dersey. And welcome to Vet Sessions.
Welcome to Vet Sessions. I'm your host today, Dr. Omar Khan. With us, we have Dr. Caitlin Everett to talk about all things histopathology. Dr. Everett graduated from OVC in 2020 and is currently doing a residency in anatomic pathology at our pathobiology department here at OVC. Welcome, Dr. Everett.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Thank you for joining us. So our usual question to guests is why did you want to become a vet and what led you down this pathway? Can you tell our listeners, you know, your path, I guess?
Absolutely. So mine is a little bit of what I would call a non-traditional path to becoming a veterinarian. Mm-hmm. I think you probably have a lot of people on the show that say, you know, I was 3 or 5 years old when I knew that this is what I wanted to do.
Yeah, pretty much most of our guests have said that. Yeah.
That certainly wasn't me. So growing up, I was always interested in sciences, interested in medicine, wasn't really sure what I wanted to do, but I kind of kept my education path going through biology. Mm-hmm. And I actually had completed my undergrad at the University of Western Ontario. I had started a master's, and in the second year of my master's, I was tasked with taking care of our lab's research animals. Mm. So I started working really closely with our animal care and veterinary services at UWO, and the veterinarians that work there are amazing, but mm-hmm. it had been about 3 or 6 months that I had been working with them to try and care for our colony of frogs. And they said, hey, what are you going to do after you graduate from your master's? We think you'd make, like, have you considered veterinary medicine? We think you'd make a really great veterinarian, because I really enjoyed research, but mm-hmm. I also really liked the animal care aspect of it. So I was in my master's degree. I applied to OVC on a whim. Yeah. I got in and wow. I never looked back.
Amazing. Yeah. Well, yeah, that certainly is not a complete departure, since you said how some of that involvement with animals, but certainly not the norm that we have from our guests for sure. And frogs, interesting. So what research were you doing with frogs?
So I was actually doing developmental biology. So they're mm-hmm. quite a good research model for that, because we can take them and they move very quickly from the tadpole to adult stage.
Yeah.
And they essentially go from being aquatic to being able to live in both aquatic and on land. And so there's a lot of different applications that they can have to different developmental pathways.
Interesting. Yeah, I remember doing dissections on frogs way back when, and wasn't something that I was too keen on. Well, that's certainly a good career path. And then at OVC, so what happened after OVC?
So while I was in OVC, I always stayed very interested in pathology and mm-hmm. lab animal medicine and things like that, but after I graduated, I did about 2.5 years in small animal general practice.
Yeah.
I loved it. I think I gained a lot of valuable information and things that I apply to my residency today, but I just knew that that wasn't my forever career goal.
Yeah.
And while I did general practice, I tried out, I did a little bit of locum, small animal ER, and then I actually got back into lab animal medicine and clinical research support. So I started that about 6 months out from graduation, and mm-hmm. I still do it today. So concurrently with my residency, I still do work as a lab animal and clinical research support vet.
Oh, wow.
It's really fun.
That's pretty busy then, I guess. Yeah.
Yes, it is quite busy, but there's a lot of things that I'm learning in my residency that are quite applicable to when I do locum and do lab animal research. Yeah. I do a lot of necropsy for them.
Yeah, to you. Okay. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was just going to ask, so what exactly happens? I mean, it's quite different from GP then.
It is very different. It's almost, sometimes when I talk to my friends that are practicing large animal, because there's a lot of colonies of different animals, so mm-hmm. you're almost doing it at a herd health basis instead. Like, there is certain aspects of individualized animal medicine, but often you're kind of thinking of things broadly and how they could affect this herd or this colony right. type of thing.
Yeah, and the research itself, I guess, too.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah,
interesting. Okay. So anatomic pathology, how does that differ from clinical pathology? What's the difference?
Yes, I will share my very simplistic or funny analogy that I always say to make it in the most simplistic sense
ClinPath is liquids and anatomic path is solids. Okay. Doesn't always follow that rule, but so blood, urine, joint fluid, cerebral spinal fluid, those, all those liquids are going to go to your clinical pathologist. Yeah. What kind of?
Or aspirates. Yeah. Like if we do a fine needle aspirate on a structure, lymph node. Yeah.
Exactly. And so that kind of bridges the gap because some clinical pathologists think about as the aspirates that we're doing, it's almost like a needle biopsy. Yeah. So that's, kind of where the division would be. Mm-hmm. And then any sort of solid tissue is what is going to go to your anatomic pathologist.
Yeah.
And then in general, our training is pretty similar. Like we do things concurrently for the first little bit. So all of our trainees here will write the same kind of phase one or first level boards. And then after that, we split to our respective branches for the second level. And here our training program is quite integrated. So anatomic pathology residents can attend any of the clinical pathology rounds, classes, et cetera, and vice versa. It's quite nice because we all share the same space. Right. So our desks are just separated by an alleyway.
Right.
So we can easily go talk to them. And it's quite nice when we are integrating our results. So often the clinical pathologist will receive it a day or two ahead of us.
Yeah.
And so when we're screening the histopath, we can pop over and ask them what their impression was from the samples they got.
So that's good. So you almost get sort of two for the price of one kind of thing, right? Yeah. Interesting. So that's good. And that's at AHL, right?
Yeah.
So something to think about.
Okay. Mm-hmm. I don't know if every lab is set up that way, but it's really nice for our training
program here. Yeah, definitely. Okay, great. Well, thank you for sharing your journey with our listeners. So we'll get into sort of our, topics today, I guess.
Yeah, of course.
And the phase we were chatting about is sample fixation, inking and packaging submissions for submitting to labs. So can you tell us some of the experiences you had and some of the samples you received? What mistakes do you see, general practitioners or veterinarians making, and how do we fix that? No pun intended.
Yeah, exactly. So essentially we're kind of going from the step of you've done the surgery, the mass is off that particular animal, pet, et cetera. Now, what do I do with it? How do I properly get it prepared in order to be received at our lab and processed appropriately?
Yeah.
So there's a couple things to start thinking about. So the first one is formalin fixation. So I think a lot of the companies that small animal practitioners and those clinics work with generally supply you jars, or it's things that you can order from your companies. So that's generally good because most of those will be plastic. Mm-hmm. We don't recommend glass. It's not that it can't be in glass, but it just could put a danger to the courier. Like it could break and not necessarily arrive at that particular lab as a whole piece.
Right.
Which wouldn't be great.
No.
Other things to think about are going to be your formalin to tissue ratio. So it's one thing if you can get it through the opening of the jar, but what if it's not the right formalin to tissue ratio and then it's not really going to fix while it's in transport to the lab. So we're often aiming for about a 10-to-1 ratio of formalin to tissue.
To tissue sample. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Exactly. So once you have, your jar, you figured out the size of the mass, the next thing is inking. Cause I think there's a lot of different information out there of like, should we ink? Should we suture? Should we staple?
Yeah.
All that sort of stuff. Mm-hmm. And certainly I think that every clinic should have ink available. Generally it's best to have at least two colors.
Yeah. And when you say ink, sorry to interrupt, is there a special ink that we can get? Like where do we get this ink from?
Generally you can talk to the specific lab that your clinic is associated with if they have particular ink preferences, because they're going to be the ones receiving it and having to process it. Yeah. So you'd rather not, upset them on the receiving end. But most of your veterinary supply stores, like where you're getting anything else to stock your clinic, you can reach out to them and see what kind of ink that they have available.
Okay.
And then there's some certain general rules of thumb that you could think about when you're kind of trying to decide what color do I pick.
Mm-hmm.
It's not always the best if you're going to have a black dog that you're taking a skin mass off to ink something
black. Yeah. True. I mean, generally, if it's got haired skin, histologically, we can tell the difference of what side is what.
Yeah.
But it's not always the best choice because there's some other colors out there.
Yeah.
There's some schools of thought too about perhaps avoiding like blue or red, because when we do our routine staining with hematoxylin and eosin, it sometimes can get confusing. I've certainly had samples here in the residency where they've been inked with blue or red. Like our lab in particular doesn't have any issues with it. Mm-hmm. But I've usually seen a lot of like yellow, greens, and oranges.
Yeah, I was going to say we have yellow, green, orange, and blue, I believe.
Yeah, that's the more common colors that we generally tend to see.
Okay.
So that's kind of what colors should I even have in clinic. It's never wrong if you have staples available to you, like if you want to staple a margin. The only issue with staples is we can't put it through our processors. Like we can't cut it with our microtome blades. So
that's right.
When I receive things with staples, I have to go about taking them out.
Yeah.
It's kind of hard. So I might actually destroy the tissue integrity along that particular margin. So
Then you may still have to ink it.
Exactly. Well, and follow up ink it.
Yeah.
We certainly have situations here because, you know, at OVC, we do a lot more advanced surgery than you would do in general practice. And like the most common tissue that we generally have come with staples in it is lung, but that's just an inherent thing of the surgery. Yeah, so we expect resection. And anticipate it. Mm-hmm. I have seen some where they might do different suture tags to denote like a lateral border or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
If all you have at your clinic is one ink and then you're going to do a suture, it's not wrong. It's just as long as you write it in the submission. And then once we receive it, we can ink the other margin for you.
Okay. Mm-hmm. So you can still ink after it's been sitting in formaldehyde. So what's the best way to ink then?
Great question. Because there are some ways that you can kind of turn your formalin into a colorful mix.
I've seen that. Yeah. It looks like Kool-Aid almost. Yeah,
it does look like Kool-Aid, the thick Kool-Aid. So ideally, we're talking about drying time. So from the time that you will take, say, a skin mass off, we do expect there to be some shrinkage, just general retraction.
Yeah.
And inherently the retraction that'll happen with the tissue. But ideally, if we can get it inked within the first like 20 to 30 minutes of it coming off is ideal.
Okay.
And the other thing is we don't recommend directly applying the ink from the bottle. So something they all already have available in the veterinary clinic will be those long Q-tips that you generally use for taking ear swabs for dogs and cats. So if you dip that, rub a little bit of the ink off on like a plate or a paper towel. So it's a very thin layer. Mm-hmm. And that's what we want. You want to coat the whole entire surface, but nothing thick.
You're right. Okay.
On it. And ideally you're inking both what your surgical impression is the deep margin, and then also what your surgical impression is going to be is the lateral, medial, et cetera, type margin, depending on just what you're taking off.
Okay, and one color for each.
One color for each, yeah. So ideally you have two colors available in clinic. We want the ink to dry a little bit before we put it in formalin. I was recently chatting with one of our faculty members and she let me know, she's like, oh, do you know about the white vinegar trick?
Right.
I was like, I don't know about the white vinegar trick. It's essentially acetic acid.
Yeah.
And so it's pretty easy. You could pick up white vinegar at the grocery store. Yeah. And so if you have like a little dish that you can put a thin layer of white vinegar in, you can just quickly dip the ink in it as well to get it to dry a little bit before you put it in formalin.
Oh, so just dip the tissue.
The tissue.
After it's inked?
Yep.
Yeah, just in that.
Yeah, and then put it in. It helps to dry. I've certainly done it too on the receiving end. If something is very freshly inked, we put it in acetic acid for a bit like 10 or 5-10 minutes just to try and dry it up before. Because the risk is if it's too wet and the ink is too wet when the technician, or at the case at OVC, it's all the graduate students that are doing it, we cut through and then we have ink on our scalpel blade that we're then tracking through the tissue. Mm. And we're trying to decide when you're looking at it, is that true or is it just iatrogenically introduced in the fact that we were cutting it with a scalpel?
Right. Okay, so that's a good tip. And that vinegar then won't damage the tissue sample.
I mean, please don't leave it for like half an hour sitting in it.
Yeah, we don't want it pickled, right?
Yeah, exactly. It's just a quick dry technique before it goes in the jar. Okay. You, despite doing all these like painting like a thin layer, and even if you try to do the acetic acid trick, some of it will come off in formalin. That's okay.
Yeah, okay. And is there any risk then, because it's happened to me certainly to make that formaldehyde Kool-Aid, is there any risk to the sample, or does it make your interpretation more challenging then? Does it leach into the tissue? Or
Generally, no. Okay. We're pretty fortunate here, though, because the hospital is just, I don't know, 50 meters away that they they walk it over to us. Certainly, we've had it sit for 24, 36 hours before it makes it to us, and there's there's no issues.
Okay.
It's a little bit more troublesome when we're thinking about sending non-formalin fixed things, so much larger specimens like limbs and things like that.
Yeah.
That if you ink it, then if it sits in a bag for 24 to 36 hours, that ink can kind of travel to other margins maybe that you don't want
it.
But formalin fixation, we generally don't have any issues with it.
Okay, great. That's good to know. And I'm going to try that next time, that vinegar trick.
Yeah.
The next time. I do the double margin inking, but I think, I'm certainly guilty of trying to put into the formaldehyde jar too quickly, and then everything becomes orange or yellow. Yeah.
I think it's fair. You have that idea that I don't want, and I've certainly been guilty of this when I was in general practice, is, you know, you take off four or five masses and you're like, oh, I don't want to forget which one's which. I don't want one to accidentally get discarded. So you want it to more quickly get in the jar just to make sure it's not lost.
Exactly. Yeah, that's right. It gets tossed away with a piece of gauze or something.
Exactly.
Yeah. No, fair enough. Thank you. Thanks for that. And I hope that our listeners try to implement some of those tricks as well too. So beyond inking, so once the sample gets to your lab, then what happens there? You said you make sections. Can you tell us a little bit more about that? Like, how do you choose the section?
Yeah, of course. So it varies depending on the tissue. So if we're thinking about just our like skin mass that has come off, so you've inked a deep margin and a lateral margin for us. And if we picture, say, it's circular, we need to be able to capture what would be areas of concern where perhaps, you know, always as a surgeon, they want to know, did I leave microscopic disease behind?
Yep, exactly.
So we're always trying to at minimally capture, we need to capture that deep margin in our sections, but generally we will take also radial sections. So almost taken at 90 degrees apart just to kind of capture a generality of where that entire lateral margin that you took could be. Mm-hmm. That's usually a good starting point. Certainly if we have areas that seem a little bit more concerning, we'll always go back and trim more.
Yeah.
But yeah, it certainly varies depending on what the tissue is. Like my approach for a spleen versus a jaw versus a leg versus a skin mass really varies.
Yeah.
But for me, I always just think about what are the particular areas that would still be contacting in the patient. And it's generally easiest if you think about that to kind of go after all the areas.
Okay. Yeah, that makes sense. And then you mentioned that formaldehyde to tissue ratio. So let's just say, for example, I had a really large mass that I took off and I was struggling to get that into a jaw. Is it acceptable then for us to section that? Does that complicate, you know, things at the lab for you all? Or do we just get a large bucket and put it in?
I think my number one choice would be if you can get a large bucket or jar that seals, that the whole thing can fit in.
Mm-hmm.
That's ideal.
Right.
If it's quite a large mass, like say like a 10 centimeter mass or bigger, you might want to, you'll have to write this in your submission form, but you might want to not do full thickness cuts, but a few cuts in it just to allow the formalin to penetrate a little bit better. Because with the courier services, if it's taking, you know, 1 to 3 days to get there, that's 1 to 3 days where it's sitting on a truck and it's almost nutating it itself and allowing the formalin to get in.
Yeah.
So that's one option. Certainly if that's not available to the general practitioner, because that certainly could happen, take lots of photos and then sample different sections of it and send, like, clearly label those jars that the smaller pieces are in and send the photo that you have of the larger mass. And then I think it's good also to just manage client expectations that's what you have to do to start with. We might have to send more pieces later on if the pathologist is recommending it.
Right.
Okay. The other thing, I've done it with one of my classmates and chatted with them who practices in a more remote area where it was a spleen. So I directed them the small pieces they could take because they didn't have a large enough jar.
Okay.
And then I just had them freeze back the rest of the spleen in their deep freezer. Mm-hmm. So that if the pathologist is requesting more, they can thaw it out and refix it. Like, certainly we have to acknowledge the fact that there might be some freeze thaw artifact in that situation.
Yeah.
But it's certainly better than nothing if we can't transport the whole thing.
Okay. Yeah, that makes sense. And then you mentioned limbs, you know, if we do sort of a limb amputation versus a simple digit, how do we go about submitting something like that being, you know, a large structure with bone in there? Yeah. So we're not going to be able to section that, you know, adequately.
Exactly. The first thing will always be contacting the lab that your clinic is associated with, because they will probably have specific preferences of, mm-hmm. of how you send it. So some labs might say, if it's only going to take 24 hours to get it to us, like put it in a biohazard bag, no formalin, mm-hmm. To be able to let them take samples as soon as it arrives. I've heard of some veterinarians that try like with small saws that they have to take saw little smaller pieces right. and send those in formalin. It would be the same thing of like, you should freeze back the rest of it type of thing. But I think most large diagnostic labs are pretty open to having that conversation about, and if you as the veterinarian are just preparing ahead of time, like they'll be your best source. Yeah. In order to answer that question and how to send it.
Yeah. Okay, good. So we reach out to the respective companies, just get their opinion.
Exactly. And what their preference is and what would be the best way to go about it.
Yeah. Okay. Interesting. And infrequently we do, you know, resection anastomoses. Yeah. What's the best way for submitting gut, let's say?
So say you do a resection and it's like 10 centimeters or something like that.
Yeah.
We generally have our surgery service here. They do ink the open lumens essentially on either side of mm-hmm. the resected gastrointestinal tract. It's nicer if you use two different colors and tell us which one is like oral and aboral.
Yeah.
Just to be able for us to give the most amount of information. Mm-hmm. But we actually had an interesting conversation in our rounds yesterday about gastrointestinal tumors, because if we have ones, for example, that have ruptured and mm-hmm. it comes back as a diagnosis of some sort of neoplasm or cancer,
yeah.
those ends that you've inked don't necessarily become the most important margin.
No, exactly.
Yeah, because it could travel and seed within the abdomen. It could travel along the serosal surface of, mm-hmm. of organs. So it's certainly great that we can provide that information, and more information is always best. But thinking about like how we would interpret what we are told about those margins and keeping that in mind with what your clinical impression is, sort of thing.
So then you come back to clinical impression history.
Yeah.
And we'll come back to that in a sec, I guess, about how do we submit appropriate histories. You mentioned pictures and so forth. Is there anything else that we need to know as a small R practitioner about submitting a sample?
No.
In terms of tissue preparation?
I think that's pretty comprehensive. I always say, when in doubt, contact your lab and your pathologist. We love to talk to the veterinarians because some of them may have never done practice. They might have done practice for a little bit. And so I like knowing about the patient and making those connections with the practitioners as well. So never be afraid to reach out to your friendly neighborhood pathologist. Because it's, and I think anyone, regardless of the specialist, appreciates when that family veterinarian makes the touch point first, because they might tell you something about the case and they might say, oh, make sure you do this, you know, X, Y, and Z before they send it. It's basically just setting up the patient, owner, everybody up for success.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. The best case outcomes. Great. Okay, so on to history then. What makes a good and complete history? Because you, as you said, you don't see the patient. You don't have much contact with the veterinarian unless we choose to reach out. So what would you like us to put into that history to give you a more thorough picture of what, you know, what could be going on?
Exactly. We're kind of looking for that Goldilocks effect where not too much, not too little, just the right amount we're able to give you the best answer possible. So I've got a nice list here of some things that we talk about that we're always kind of looking for. So the first thing, and I guess I should back up and say that every lab will vary in their submission form. So you kind of have to work within the confines of how that particular company wants things submitted.
Fair enough.
But the first thing that it'll always prompt you to do is the signalement. Yeah. So age, reproductive status, breed, etc. It seems obvious, but I always like to do the discussion point about reproductive status. And some submitting forms, your kind of forced into, or for how your computer system says it kind of forces you to update. So like, for example, if the patient was seeing you for like an intra-abdominal mass and you think it's a testis,
yeah,
and then you do the scrotal neuter at the same time. So say you click off on the form that it's male neutered.
Yeah.
But at the time that the disease developed and what you were concerned about, the patient was technically intact.
Right.
So some of the forms, because they're linked to your overall computer system that you have at the clinic, it's, oh, it was neutered. It automatically forces you to say neutered. So right. You want to put, if that happens, put something in the history that like at the time that this disease was occurring, the patient was actually intact. Mm-hmm. So same thing, like say you go in to do a mammary mass removal, you spay at the same time.
Yeah.
I guess the patient is technically spayed, but at the time that your concern developed,
yeah,
she was intact. Yeah. So that's helpful for us to have that little piece of information.
Okay, good.
Because I've had that experience where some of the computer systems force it after that surgery to just automatically put it.
Yeah.
But it's nice to include in the actual typed history.
Okay, makes sense.
We want to talk about the lesion-specific clinical history. So like the skin mass example mm-hmm. that we keep going back to, how long was it present, either monitored at the clinic or noted by
yeah.
the animal's family? And what was it like during the progression? Like when it was first noted, did it rapidly get larger? Has it always kind of stayed the same?
Right.
Did it ever open up and have discharge that would yeah. wax and wane? All those things are important. And then what type of therapies you tried as the general practitioner? Mm-hmm. And then, say we tried antibiotics, seemed to reduce in size, or tried antibiotics, didn't change anything. Like I said, I always go back to more information is better. Like if you choose to write antibiotics, that's fine. I always want to know like the brand or
yeah, class which one and exactly. duration perhaps. And yeah.
Exactly. And then after that, if you think there's any like lesion specific clinical signs, so say we're removing a mass on a limb, was that patient lame?
Yeah.
Based on where it was or how it grew. And that kind of links into making sure you tell us to the best of your ability the anatomical location it is on the patient, but also pictures. Mm-hmm. I will never say no yeah. to like an 8.5 by 11 printed out photo yeah, that got folded up.
Okay. Fair enough. And I was just going to say, how do we submit those pictures, right? So
yeah, if you can directly email them to the lab, that's great. But mm-hmm. if all you have is the ability to print something out,
yeah,
it's better than nothing.
Yeah, exactly.
And I think a surgery service or a surgeon would be happy to know that most family veterinarians are also taking before and after photos.
Yeah.
Photos are nice for us to have as a pathology team, but afterwards, depending what happens.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And even if I think it makes a complete, patient medical record as well from the practitioner's end. This will look like before, this will look after. And especially if we have to go back in and revise those margins, right?
Exactly, yeah. Exactly. Yes, the general rule of thumb is we should be taking pictures anyways
yeah, and having yeah, them. Everyone has their phone on them.
Exactly.
So, yeah, take a picture, yeah.
The other thing, just general clinical history, like if we're going in to say your suspicions for moving up this mass is a mast cell tumor, but you also know that this patient previously had 5 others removed, it'd be great if you could tell us if you have grade and location for each of those masses, what was mm-hmm. the orientation or anatomical orientation to this current mass you're taking off
yeah.
to all the other ones. Were they clustered? Are we on the opposite end of the dog type of situation? Mm-hmm. Any sort of additional diagnostics that you did? So routinely we're doing CBC and serum biochemistry, I think at minimum yeah. these days beforehand.
Yeah, typically, yeah.
Yeah. So if you had any sort of abnormalities on that you wanted to let us know, if you've done urine, any sort of imaging, like that's also, mm-hmm. it's also nice to know if you as the submitting veterinarian feel that could be pertinent to the case. Yeah.
Is there something more systemic versus just exactly. a local peripheral, skin bump or something of that nature? Yeah.
Exactly. Especially if we're going to remove something that we have the suspicion of it being neoplastic. I think there's a lot of veterinarians out there that at minimum will take the 3-view thoracic rods. Mm-hmm. So, we took 3-view thoracic rods, they sent to a radiologist and they're suspicious for
yeah.
perhaps a metastasis or something like that. Right. Like that's pertinent information.
Yeah.
For us to have. If you did any cytology beforehand. So if you did a fine needle aspiration of it, mm-hmm. what is the diagnosis, what are the potential differential diagnoses, or the fact that we did a fine needle aspiration and we couldn't get any diagnosis off of it. Like, that's also very helpful for us going into it.
And as you mentioned that, I was just going to ask too. So yeah, sometimes we may do an FNA before just to maybe help guide with margins or give the owner a bit more of a prognostic indicator. Mm-hmm. What about if we do lymph node aspirates at the time of how, because obviously you're looking at the histopath, the cytology goes somewhere else. So how do those results get correlated somehow? Do we just put in the submission form, okay, find needle aspirates and the lymph nodes, please check with lab results? So does it depend on the lab, I guess?
I think it depends on the lab. Like, we're really fortunate here with the animal health lab and the residency programs, like, are all pretty integrated. So it's easier for me to access that information, but it's better, I think, for the family veterinarian or general practitioner to just think about the fact and treat it that the anatomic pathologist doesn't have access to what the clinical pathologist might have said.
Right.
So yeah, it's great if you're thinking about aspirating lymph nodes at the, like, ahead of time.
Yeah.
To just include that.
Yeah. Great. Okay. So thank you so much for that background information on doing the history and what, you know, pathologists would like to see versus what we sometimes give them. I'll do my best to improve on that, or maybe get the students to at least. So we've submitted our samples. You've had a look at them and you've generated a nice, you know, one or two or three page report for us that we get back. How do we, as, you know, general practitioners, primary care veterinarians, decipher that information?
Yeah, because it's those 1 to 3 pages pack a lot of information.
Definitely.
And it can sometimes be overwhelming.
It can be scary sometimes.
Exactly, to work its way through. So it'll certainly vary depending on the lab that your clinic is associated with. And I feel like I'm a broken record. They're all pretty similar, but they do some different things.
Yeah. They do, definitely.
Yeah. So for us here, we always re-include the provided submitted history. Mm-hmm. And then in our reports, we also describe what we received.
Yeah.
So we'll say received are however many jars, and then we like to describe what's in each jar. We describe to you how we sampled it and what's going to be present on each slide.
Okay.
It almost works like a checkpoint for us.
Yeah.
So if you're like, great, they received 3 jars and the number of tissues that I put in each matches up, or if you're like, well, wait, I sent 5 jars.
Right, yeah.
So I need to get in contact with the company or the courier to try and track it down.
Yeah, figure out what happened,
So that's a nice little checkpoint to have in there. So if your lab does that, the first thing is you can say, great, everything that I gave to the courier actually showed up and was processed. Mm-hmm. And then the next, what generally becomes the bulk of the report, is actually the microscopic description.
Mm-hmm.
So it can either be done slide by slide if each slide has a different mass or a different tissue on it, or we can go like mass by mass type of thing.
Yeah.
And so we'll tell you how many samples we're looking at. Mm-hmm. And then we launch into what I say that we're seeing in the pink and purple abyss.
Right. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, exactly. So we're describing a lot of it. We like to do is low power and really describe the location in which we're seeing the lesion. So for example, in skin, is it mainly epidermal, dermal, subcutis? Does it span everything? Does when you were actually doing your removal as a surgeon, did you take muscle, etc.? Like, we like to tell you everything that we have that we're looking at. Mm-hmm. You'll get a lot of information about what that particular mass is like. So is it expansile? Is it infiltrative, that sort of thing. Like I said, we spend a lot of time talking about location and how this particular mass is really distributed in the tissue for us. Okay. And then for there, you're going to launch into what does it look like on a cellular level?
Mm-hmm.
I think the one thing that a lot of practitioners always go to is the mitotic count. For some people, the mitotic count would be our aberrant or abnormal looking like chromatin in the nucleus type of thing. When we're looking at it at a cellular level, it's not nice and round. It's actually an actively dividing cell that we are looking for. Because when you're kind of doing some generalities, I think a lot of people think that the higher the might not account the worst it's going to be. It's not a general rule for every tumor, but I think for a lot of practitioners, that's the thing that you're going to look for.
Yes.
And then after that, you're going to go look for your margins. Okay. And how well did I do?
Yeah.
Kind of getting it for microscopic disease. And as pathologists, we will always describe what the margin is. So whether it was subcutis, muscle, etc. And then we will always say the distance from the inked margin. And we will, in your history, you will provide what you inked. And then so we will always say to those inked boundaries. It's a nice checkpoint too, because if your surgical impression was when you were taking off this mask, you're like, no, I took right down to the muscle. And we are telling you that histologically we're not seeing any muscle. That'll kind of prompt the conversation between surgeon and pathologist of like, okay, did we just not capture it in section? Do we need to go back and look a little bit, a little bit more? So, as overwhelming as that description can be, I think it's important for the veterinarian to read it because you need to correlate that with what your impression was when you did the surgery. Yeah,
makes sense.
Along with the description, we will often give a percent of it that is necrotic. So potentially like non-viable aspects of the mass, depending on what neoplasm or what it is that is or is not pertinent, but we like to give that information. And the other thing that often our oncology team is looking for is any sort of invasion. So is it invading into what the surgeon tried to get is our compartment boundary, so our deep margin, but does it have vascular invasion, lymphatic invasion, any sort of if it's a bone tumor, like where is it potentially, or how is it associated with the bone, et cetera, because that is important for next steps for the patient. And invasion in generally is kind of a negative prognostic indicator. So that will also help you as the veterinarian on the receiving end of the report, kind of how you want to guide your client of what do you want to do next. Because that piece of information might sway or help them in what they would like to do next.
So, and that's an interesting point you raise, and I've seen that in some reports, vascular versus lymphatic invasion. I would think, and correct me if I'm wrong, that that, you know, most humans will have some degree of vascular at least invasion. So how do we make sense then if they say vascular is that quantified in some way when we get a report? Or
so we can sometimes describe what vessels we're seeing it in, like is it small capillaries, venules, arterioles, et cetera, and where that vasculature is in regards to the mass. Because you're right, it is a generality for cancer and neoplasia. In order for it to have that unlimited growth, often a factor of it is it needs to make its own blood supply. And so we're more looking in the vasculature surrounding or what would be in the more normal tissue, like in the lumen of the vessels. Am I actually seeing the same neoplastic cells? And there are some very generalities, like for example, carcinomas tend to go lymphatic versus sarcomas tend to go hematogenous. But like I said, cancer does what cancer wants, so it doesn't have to follow that rule necessarily. So yeah, we're more wanting to look at any of the more normal vasculature that we have surrounding that particular mass to be able to comment.
All right, thank you. Thanks for clarifying that. In terms of margin distance, and I agree, that's what most of us are concerned about. Do we capture that entire structure? Is it going to come back? What do we tell the owners? How is that measured? And how much faith do we put into that?
So there's one thing to consider when we're thinking about margins is there is going to be inherent shrinkage that happens. So like we previously talked about, when you take the skin mask off, there's automatic contracture. But this tissue is going through formalin fixation, so cross-linking there, and then it goes through a series of hydration and dehydration steps. So, you know, anywhere upwards of 30-40% could actually be shrunken. Our oncologists are quite good and prepared for that. Like they recognize the fact that the margins that existed when this mass was in situ in the patient is not what is going to be necessarily reflected when we're reporting it out. So they are very aware in making their decisions based on those differences.
Okay. All right. So then what we see is that factor taken into account? Let's just say that I know that I took 2 centimeter margins based on measurements and rulers, and then you tell me, or the pathologist tells me, oh yeah, there's 3 millimeter margin. How do I then, is that all, is shrinkage taken into account there, or is there really only 3 millimeters and there probably is some tendrils of you know, tumors in that patient still?
Exactly. So we as pathologists are not doing any math. We're telling you what we see down the microscope. Yeah. So we are reporting objective numbers.
Okay. Good.
And so if you, likely when you're doing your measurements with your ruler, you're doing it kind of what you can see grossly.
Yes.
And then cancer does what cancer wants.
Correct.
It's like that iceberg effect is, you know, we can see so much of it, but we don't know what's happening further down. And like you said, like if we're talking about a spindle type neoplasm, they're just sending out tendrils all throughout. And you would never, as a surgeon, really be able, you can't see that.
No, you can't. Exactly. Yeah.
Exactly. Okay. So yeah, we report what we see.
Okay. All right. Well, that's good to know. Is there anything else that we should know about the interpretation when we get that report back?
Yeah, so there's 2 more sections, I guess, that I haven't talked about. So the one is the diagnosis section, which, you know what, I'm guilty when I was in general practice that I would just...
Oh, yeah, we just skip. Yeah,
right? Hop right to it. Yeah. You bypass all of that lovely, lovely description.
That's true.
That your pathologist has written, and you hop to the diagnosis to decide, does this fit with... what I thought beforehand or not. Mm-hmm. And then after that, when you're like, okay, usually if it's something benign, then you're like, phew, this is going to be an easier conversation to have with the client. But if it's something that you weren't expecting and it's something a little bit more sinister, the next section you're hopping to is that comment.
Mm-hmm.
And the comment varies depending on lab.
Yeah.
So here when I'm writing my comment, I am directing what I am giving advice-wise to a specialist. So I don't really need to be reporting back to them, you know, the prognostic indicators, what else you should be doing next sort of thing. So the comments that we generate here, we don't do that. But when I was a general practitioner and pathologist that are more geared towards that, the comments are really helpful for guiding you for next steps.
Yeah.
When you don't necessarily know what to do. Mm-hmm. Usually they will give you perhaps a little bit about prognosis if that particular pathologist feels comfortable quoting the most recent literature.
Okay.
But often we will say things like, oh, next step might be to reach out to an internal medicine specialist, an oncologist, or a surgeon, et cetera. Yeah. And then... when you're working with these larger diagnostic companies, you often have the luxury of actually just hopping on the phone and saying, the pathologist that works with you is actually recommending that I call you now. So can we chat about this and what we might want to do next sort of thing?
Yeah. Okay. All right. So that's good to know. So it then becomes lab specific, but as I said, here at OVC, we have everyone sort of somewhat integrated.
Exactly.
So we have that luxury, but if you use an independent company, they may have pathologists and or oncologists and internal medicine people on staff that they can then reach out to get further clarification or next steps with respect to treatment.
Exactly. Yeah. Or the next person you might be reaching out to is the pathologist, because you're like, this is not at all what I thought the clinical impression was going to be. I didn't even have this on my differentials list.
Yeah.
Can we have a touch point where we can talk more about what you were seeing and kind of how that led you to this this diagnosis? And the pathologist might ask you more questions that maybe at the time you didn't think was pertinent to the history, but as they're asking you, you're like, oh, okay, that particular entity or you know, happened 3 months ago to the patient, I guess that does fit more with this diagnosis.
Okay. Good. So coming back to interpretation, so firstly, we get sort of your overall impression of the structure in situ, what it looks like, expansive, infiltrative, and then you delve deeper into the actual cellular structure, and then we get our diagnosis and comments, which we should certainly review, and then reach out to our friendly neighborhood pathologist if we have any questions, and we go from there. Does that sound fair?
Yeah. And the other thing that I just remembered from my time in general practice, some of our larger companies now are actually including images from whether if the slides were digitized, they'll take a screen capture and include it in the report, or something that they're taking directly with the microscope.
Yeah.
And I think that's an added layer of a checkpoint, because it's nice as the person on the receiving end of the report, I can read the description of where it is in the tissue, and then I get to look back to the photo that they've provided me. And then they will also do ones that are on a higher power generally to see the cellular features as well. So it's a nice matching to what they're describing.
Yeah, I've seen that definitely, but it's all, you know, Greek to me. I can't see. I was never good at pathology and microscope work in vet school. So I'm always fascinated when I get mitotic counts and how do they see that? What are they looking at? Mm-hmm. But it's good to know that it's there and it's available. So thank you for that. Thank you so much for joining us today. It was very eye-opening for me. Something that I don't think about very much when we do tissue samples and how to write a good history. I will do my best going forward to impart that on my students. Thank you again. And thanks so much for joining me today.
You are most welcome. That's all we can hope, is that everyone takes a little something away that they could improve for their submissions.
Yeah, I mean, that's why we do this, right?
It'll make a world of a difference.
Yeah, thanks again. Thank you to our listeners for joining us today. I hope you've gained some valuable knowledge or remembrances and put them into practice. I'd also like to thank our sponsors, Pet Trust. This episode of Vet Sessions is sponsored by Pet Trust OVC. OVC Pet Trust supports innovative discoveries that improve the prevention, diagnosis, and treatment of diseases of pets. Thanks to their incredible donors, each year, OVC Pet Trust invests more than $600,000 into research projects and equipment to benefit pet health and well-being in many areas of veterinary medicine, including cancer, cardiology, diagnostic imaging, emergency and critical care, infectious diseases, internal medicine, neurology, nutrition, ophthalmology, pain management, and anesthesia, surgery, the human-animal bond, and much, much more. To support OVC Pet Trust, visit www.pettrust.ca/donate today. Thanks, everyone. Take care.